In the next hour on Morning Ireland, more overnight deaths and no ceasefire in Gaza, more Western sanctions on Russia. Is the criminal justice system failing young men? World War I stories, and in sport, a look ahead to the Galway Plate, honours for Jim Bulger and Dermot Wells, and Kerry legend Maurice Fitzgerald looks back at a famous football quarter-final.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 30th of July. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Gavin Jennings and Rachel English.
The headlines: the Israeli military is continuing to bombard Gaza. Another United Nations school where people had been sheltering has been hit. AIB has recorded its first profit in 6 years. The Immigrant Council of Ireland has said the government needs to do more to protect victims of human trafficking. And the last surviving member of the US air crew that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima has died. Brian Jennings has the news in full.
At least 43 Palestinians were killed in northern Gaza overnight, 20 of whom were sheltering in a school in Jabalia when it was shelled. Among the dead were a medical assistant and an infant. An Israeli army spokeswoman said she was checking if it had carried out the bombing. A Palestinian official said that 8 people, including 5 members of the same family, were killed in other airstrikes. Israel said it launched its offensive in response to rocket salvos fired by Gaza's dominant Hamas Islamists and their allies. Paul Hirschen from Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the military tried hard to limit casualties.
You have to remember this is not a pure science. I don't know if you've ever been in combat, but it's a horrible place to be. It's an ugly place to be. It's precisely why we said so clearly and consistently for the 3 weeks leading up to this conflict that we didn't want to be in it. It's precisely why we accepted every ceasefire proposal that was put on the table.
On this programme, a humanitarian aid worker, Mohammed Al-Sharif, who's in Gaza, said some 250,000 Palestinians were now displaced within the territory. With the main power plant destroyed, he described the difficulties in bringing relief to people in Gaza.
We have 10 lines, electricity, power lines coming from Israel. So far, 8 out of 10 has been cut down or destroyed. With regards to medicine, yes, there are supplies coming in, but with the thousands of injured people, hardly hospitals and the Ministry of Health is hardly surviving or managing the resources that they have.
Hospital officials put the total number of Palestinians killed in the conflict at more than 1,200, most of whom were civilians. On the Israeli side, 53 soldiers and 3 civilians have been killed since the start of the offensive 22 days ago. AIB has reported a pre-tax profit of €437 million for the first half of the year. In the same period last year, the bank posted a loss of €838 million. It is the first time the bank has recorded a profit since 2008. On this programme, the bank's chief executive, David Duffy, welcomed a reduction in arrears.
The overall situation in terms of arrears has improved significantly. I think we have seen a 6% reduction in average arrears, and we've seen a 9% reduction in the homeowner territory, which is of significant concern rather than buy-to-lets. Where it's a home, we want to keep people in their home wherever possible. There have been about 80 repossessions, but the great majority of that's entirely voluntary.
The Immigrant Council of Ireland has called on the government to ensure that shortfalls in Irish law are addressed in a new action plan on human trafficking. The national plan has been promised for the autumn. The council is making the call today, the first UN-designated World Day Against Trafficking. Joan O'Sullivan reports.
Ireland needs a robust national action plan which will provide proper supports and protections for victims of trafficking, as well as laws to jail those behind it, according to the Immigrant Council of Ireland. In a statement, the council said the process of formally identifying victims needed to be improved, and victims should be provided with secure accommodation and full legal support. It also said laws needed to be introduced to target the buyers of sex who fuel the demand for trafficking. Chief Executive Denise Charlton said the proposed plan was an opportunity for the government to send out a strong message that Ireland is not a soft target for traffickers. The Central Statistics Office estimates that traffickers are part of a black economy here that makes over €1 billion a year.
A US tourist who suffered permanent injuries in a violent assault in Temple Bar in Dublin 2 years ago has praised Gardaí for finding his attackers. Yesterday, they received jail sentences of up to 5 years. Garth Russell echoed the concern raised by the trial judge that the three culprits had been at large and free to commit crime despite a litany of previous offences. Louise Byrne reports.
Garth Russell still has glass embedded under his eye following the attack in Temple Bar in April 2012. Mr. Russell and his brother Patrick were targeted after they intervened to try and stop a robbery. They were chased down the quays and attacked with glass bottles. The New York stockbroker was not in court yesterday, but in a statement last night he said what happened was far from what he expected from his trip to Dublin. During sentencing, Judge Patrick McCartan said the juvenile justice system did not seem capable of dealing with the men at the centre of this case. Echoing the judge's comments, Mr. Russell said the number of previous encounters his attackers had with the law was troubling. He praised the work of Gardaí in tracking down the gang and said he now wants to put the experience behind him.
The last surviving member of the US air crew that dropped the first atomic bomb, which was on the Japanese city of Hiroshima in August 1945, has died. Theodore Van Kirk, who was 93, was the navigator of the Enola Gay, the aircraft that dropped the bomb. Although he denounced the use of nuclear weapons in later life, he justified the Hiroshima bombing, contending that it had helped to end the Second World War.
Everyone condemns it, especially the young people. They don't study it enough to know why we dropped the bomb. And why we dropped the bomb was there was a war going on. And the only pay I know to win a war is to force the enemy to submit.
Now the time is 7 minutes past eight. The weather forecast, there'll be scattered outbreaks of rain in the north and in the northwest today. It'll be generally dry over the rest of the country with sunny spells. However, later in the day, there'll be drizzle in northern parts of Leinster and Munster. Highest temperatures will range from 18 to 22 degrees.
What it says in Wednesday's papers.
The Irish Independent and Irish Examiner both lead with the shock of Michael O'Flynn, who, with his brother John, is one of the main shareholders and directors of the Cork-based O'Flynn Construction Group, on learning that an interim examiner has been appointed to four of its key companies. The action has been initiated by the US private equity giant Blackstone, that in May bought the debts of the companies, totaling €1.8 billion, for €1 billion. In his statement to the media, Mr. O'Flynn said that the loans are fully serviced and that all payments are fully up to date. The Irish Times business section leads with this story, but the main one for the Times this morning is based on a tax policy initiative to be unveiled later today by Richard Bruton, Minister for Jobs, to encourage job creation from foreign direct investment in the years ahead by retaining Ireland's 12.5% corporation tax regime for foreign investors while closing off tax loopholes. All three papers, The Independent, Times and Examiner, also cover the story that an American judge has quashed a motion taken by the bankrupt property developer Sean Dunn to question, under oath, the chief executive of NAMA. Every paper also covers yesterday's highly complex court case in Roscommon Circuit Court, which resulted in the jailing of a 41-year-old man following his conviction for defrauding a vet of €250,000 in a land deal which never took place. The man, who has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, admitted that while he had a wife and three children, he also has two fiancés here and has had a child with a fourth woman in Poland. The Herald, Irish Daily Star and Irish Daily Sun all lead with this story. The Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, leads with the results of a Barnardo survey about the costs of sending a child to school, more than €700 per child in some cases, plus more for incidentals. Sums the organisation says are crippling some families. So what else? The Gherkin, the iconic London building now in receivership, is to be sold. That's in the Examiner. Eating more than your recommended five-a-day portions of fruit and vegetables will not increase health benefits further, according to a new study. That's in the Times. And in light of the furore about the use of Skellig Michael for filming, the Examiner highlights another bird conservation matter. Dan McCarthy writes that a tern breeding project over the past 20 years has been, in its own terms, spectacularly successful, with three species of tern thriving and breeding on islands off Dublin, and one, the roseate, now representing 80% of that bird's European population. The roseate, we're told, immigrates here from the coast of West Africa, whereas the Arctic tern, also the subject of conservation, flies to and from the Antarctic, the longest journey undertaken by birds of any species. The Independent reports that 24 of the companies that attended last year's Web Summit, a technology festival for startup firms in Dublin, went on collectively to raise more than €200 million in funding. And this year, the event, now known simply as The Summit, has decided to host 200 startups, but competition to get in is fierce. Nicole Kane, a teenager from County Carlow, gave her mother a letter to be hand-delivered to the Pope when she met him to explain the effects of clerical child abuse. And the Pope wrote back, "Dear Nicole, I'm grateful that you wanted to share your thoughts with me, and I will not forget what you said. Thank you for being such a support to your mother. I'm remembering you both in my prayers. Sincerely, Francis." That's in many of the papers and on the front page of the Times. And finally, did you know that there is an international children's summer camp in North Korea? The Examiner tells us that Song Do-won has just reopened after a facelift, ready to host this year's flock of more than 300 young children and teenagers from Russia, China, Tanzania, Vietnam, and Ireland. It has been operating for almost 30 years, and officials say they're willing to accept children from anywhere, even the USA, to play on their water slides, volleyball courts, and a private beach. And of course, to admire the camp's centrepieces, giant bronze statues of the late leaders Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, surrounded by adoring tots.
Thank you very much, Deirdre. So Russia faces new rounds of sanctions from both the United States and the European Union over its continued support for rebels in eastern Ukraine. In Washington, President Barack Obama said that if Russia continued on its current path, the costs would continue to grow. Meanwhile, almost 2 weeks after the shooting down of a Malaysian airliner over Ukraine, the EU reached agreement on its first broad economic sanctions against Moscow. Joining us are the Financial Times Brussels Bureau Chief Peter Spiegel and Chris Weaver, who's an economist with Macro Advisory Consultants in Moscow. Peter, to you first of all, what exactly has the EU now agreed?
Well, as he said, for the first time, they've gone from targeting individuals and companies, specific individuals, to broad economic sanctions against entire sectors of the Russian economy. And the three main sectors they focused on were the financial sector. So they went after basically every large state-owned Russian bank, which is a vast majority of the Russian banking system. They went after the energy sector by targeting a lot of the technologies that those companies need for sort of, you know, developing in deep water drilling, shale gas, some of these sort of high-end technologies that they're exploring. And lastly was the defense sector, so a blanket arms embargo with no retroactivity, very importantly. So existing contracts can go through, but in the future, no arms shipments to Russia. So for the first time, they're literally targeting entire sectors of the Russian economy.
A number of countries were seen as reluctant to impose further sanctions, and I know there was quite a spat last week between France and Britain. So has all of that changed?
It has to a certain extent. Now, again, the big spat between France and Britain was over this issue of retroactivity in the arms embargo. The French have a €1.2 billion contract to sell the Russian Navy these Mistral-class helicopter attack vessels. Now, this has been something that it's not only the Brits who have complained about this, the Swedes, the Poles, the Baltics. There are a lot of countries who have been very open about this. And actually, the Lithuanian president last night, after the sanctions were agreed, sort of went out publicly and said that she still thinks this is kind of shameful that the French are still shipping this vessel. What was happening in the negotiations was the insistence by the French and others that they have basically these carve-outs so that their domestic industry don't get hit too hard. There was similar narrowing of the energy sanctions. Originally, they were going after some of these gas technologies the Russians need for the gas industry. Obviously, the Germans and others need Russian gas for the domestic energy market, and was concerned about retaliation. So a lot of these things in the negotiations were scaled back. The only one that really wasn't, to be honest with you, and I know Britain's come under a lot of criticism for its failure to be more aggressive, but the financial sanctions did not really change. Britain, obviously, London being the financial center of Europe, that's the place that is going to take the most serious sanctions, because the Russian banking sanctions, I would argue, is the most significant one out there, the one that's going to have the biggest impact on Russia and potentially in London. So that was the negotiation that went over the course of last week. But at this point, those who were resistant, those who were reluctant, have signed on because they were able to get some concessions in the negotiations.
There was a question mark last night, I know, over whether one particular bank would be included, quite an important bank. Has it been included?
This, I think you're talking about Sberbank, which according to everyone I've talked to, is indeed included. The definition of the banks that the EU is going after are banks that are more than 50% owned by Russian government entities. And Sberbank is indeed more than 50% owned by Russian government entities. And I can tell you that was a topic of discussion, because there are some, Sberbank has subsidiaries and branches in some European countries, so they were looking at ways to make sure that those subsidiaries weren't hit. But Sberbank, which is the largest Russian bank by far, when you judge by assets, is indeed be on the list. Oddly, the Americans came out with their own list last night. As you mentioned, President Obama came out the list, added new Russian banks, but Sberbank wasn't on it. So, slightly odd. We're trying to figure out today why that was. But to be honest with you, for the first time since the Ukraine conflict started, we have the EU actually taking tougher measures than the U.S. The U.S. has not done really sectoral sanctions. They have continued to do, they did some bit on the energy industry. They continue on the financial side, at least, hitting individual banks as opposed to going to whole classes of financial institutions.
Chris Weaver, to bring you in on this, what's your assessment of what the EU announced last night?
Well, it's, as you say, this is certainly a significant step up in the attack against the economy for the first time. We do have this kind of direct impact on or potentially negative impact on the economic activity. What it basically will mean, and I'm focusing on the restrictions in the banking sector in particular, certainly the more serious short term, it means that the debt market in Russia is certainly going to tighten for companies, small, medium-sized enterprises in particular, for individuals. They're going to find it a lot more difficult to get access to new debt, and the cost of servicing existing debt is certainly going to rise as the market tightens. So that higher debt servicing cost on existing debt and it greater difficulty in accessing new debt is very likely going to have an impact on activity, on the consumer sector, on investment by industry, and that's what's going to pull down growth. We had GDP growth in Russia of 1.1% in the first half of the year, just about avoiding a recession. The IMF last week came out with a substantially revised downwards forecast for the full year of 0.2%. So they're looking for a significant retraction in the economy in the second half. That's still based on kind of almost the situation getting worse. The sanctions that we saw last night in the banking sector make life difficult, but they don't collapse the economy. The banks, for example, only have to refinance $20 billion of external debt between now and the end of the year. They should be able to get that from state resources, perhaps from some Asian banks. But it is the impact on the broader domestic debt market, and specifically the threat that now that we've moved into stage three sanctions, that any subsequent sanctions will be even will have more of a direct and negative impact on the economy.
Mind you, people might ask if there are any indications that any of the previous sanctions had any effect on Vladimir Putin and on his policies in Ukraine.
No, clearly not. And we certainly were surprised that we've moved to stage three sanctions at this now. We weren't expecting that. But, you know, the downing of the Malaysian aircraft, and in particular, the criticism of Russia's reaction in the aftermath of that tragedy, you know, has completely changed the picture. It has changed the situation totally, particularly as regards to Europeans. As the previous speaker said, the Europeans have now taken over from the US as like more aggressive sanctions, and that's specifically down to the airline tragedy and their aftermath. So we have entered a new phase. Sanctions thus far have been what we would refer to as the inconvenient category, targeting individuals, targeting some companies that weren't that big in the economy. The game has completely changed as of last night.
Peter Spiegel, if these sanctions don't work, and if there's no sign of a softening of Vladimir Putin's line, what then?
Well, they talked quite a bit. We got briefed late last night by some of the officials that worked on these things. The code word is scalability. So it was quite a large options paper that went to all the ambassadors about last week, sort of 10 pages worth of options they had. They went for a sort of minimalist approach, particularly on the financial sanctions. They just went after banks. It is certainly possible one of the options they've looked at for potential in the future is go after all state-owned enterprises, so not just the financial sector, but other big Russian companies that are owned by the state. Other parts of the financial sector, sovereign bonds, for instance, you know, preventing Russia from selling its own debt, raising its own money on European markets. So there are other things they can do to try to ratchet up the pressure. But you raise a very good point, because not only has Russia thus far not reacted in ways that the Europeans and Americans have wanted, as a matter of fact, what we've seen Western intelligence agencies tell us is they've actually escalated. We've seen, you know, movement of far more heavy weaponry into Ukraine. We've seen, you know, much more intelligence showing that they are sort of doubling down, to coin a phrase, in eastern Ukraine. The question is, as this begins to hit the broader Russian economy, particularly the elites, let's remember, this is a country that over the last 20 years like to see itself as a European country, particularly these elites who live in London, who ski in Austria, who go to the beach in Spain. I mean, they like to travel and participate in European life. If suddenly they find themselves barred from a lot of these activities, does that put pressure on the regime? There's a lot of... Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, you're okay. Listen, what we will do, though, is we'll leave it at that, because I know we have to go to another call on another line. But thank you very much indeed, both of you, for joining us. Peter Spiegel there of the Financial Times, and also Chris Weaver, who's an economist with Macro Advisory Consultants. They're based in Moscow.
So more than 1,200 Palestinians are dead. 55 Israelis are dead. Much of Gaza is in ruins, and rockets are still being fired across both sides of the Israeli border. Is there an end in sight? What is Israel's chief backer, the United States, doing to help? Peter Matthews is a U.S. political analyst and university professor. He spoke to us earlier.
Well, the U.S. is the biggest backer of Israel, as we all know, politically and certainly militarily as well as diplomatically. And if the president really wants to put some pressure on Israel, he could do that. But there are also domestic concerns in the United States. You know, I've got a book out that I just published called Dollar Democracy with Liberty and Justice for Some, How to Reclaim the American Dream for All. And my basic thesis is that money in American politics, private money, corporate lobbyist money, and other special interest group money, has basically slanted American policy against the middle class, the working people in America, and in favor of the 1%. And that also applies in foreign policy. There have been many foreign policy groups that are really well organized, very articulated with what they believe in, and they are also funded well, and they basically influence the Congress to go in certain directions regarding certain specific countries in the world. So this is a problem of American politics, that it's very difficult to get a good, objective, and comprehensive policy, domestic or foreign policy, because of wealthy special interest control and influence in the country. But immediately people are dying, and I would say that it behooves Israel to really recognize a ceasefire, and for Hamas also to stop right now, because otherwise, you know, thousands are going to die unnecessarily, and it's very tragic.
Is there any divergence of opinion at political level on this conflict?
Yes. Matter of fact, I've looked at the latest Gallup poll, and I found that it's so amazing that 40% of Americans believe that Israel is unjustified in doing what it's doing right now, and 42% say that it is justified. It's very closely divided. And yet the entire U.S. Congress, almost the entire U.S. Congress, and the president also, has said that Israel has a right to do what they're doing, basically, in order to defend themselves. It's quite a disconnect between the views of the American people, which is divided, and the views of the leaders. And I think that has to do with special interest control. One more thing, if you don't mind me saying, and that is, if you look at the generational divide in this poll, you find that younger people between 18 and 29 years old overwhelmingly say that Israel is not justified in doing what it's doing. Here's the numbers right here. 25% say Israel is justified, and 51% say Israel is unjustified in doing what it's doing. That's the 18 to 29-year-olds. When you go to the 50 to 64-year-olds, it's 53% that say Israel is justified, and 29% say Israel is unjustified. So you've got a real generational gap here in how Israel is perceived and what it's doing. And that would behoove Israel to take note of that, because while this generation leadership and some of the people in this country support what they're doing regardless of the consequences, the younger people are much more willing to look at things objectively and be more measured to to guarantee both states security and peace. The two-state solution with pre-67 borders is the real solution, in my view, and the next generation is going to be pushing that more. So why have all these folks dying in the process? It's very tragic.
Is there a point in this conflict, whatever about medium or long term, Peter, at which the number of deaths becomes too much and might force the U.S. to withdraw support for Netanyahu?
I think there will come a time of that. It has to do also with an American media. It seems to me the media in the United States is now opening up a little bit more to look at the conflict in a more measured, more careful, more balanced way to report the carnage on one side particularly. Prior to that, the media was ignoring the imbalance of carnage, and so with the American media a bit more open now to reporting the truth more carefully, I think there's a chance there'll be a shift in policy, especially, like I mentioned, the younger generation supporting a more balanced view.
That was Peter Matthews, a US-based political analyst and university professor, speaking to us earlier.
Turn immediately to another story. That news coming into us about the deaths of at least 43 Palestinians in Gaza early today, as Israel said it targeted Islamist militants at dozens of sites across the coastal enclave. Joining us on the line is Robert Turner. He's the director of UNRWA, which is the UN's relief agency in Gaza. Thanks indeed for taking our call. What can you tell us about what happened overnight?
Well, the most deplorable incident is that we had one of our emergency shelters struck by what seems to be at least three Israeli artillery shells at about 5 o'clock this morning. This was a designated emergency shelter in which 3,300 people had taken refuge. The coordinates of this school had been passed to the Israeli authorities on 17 different occasions, including last night. I mean, this is a terrible violation of international law, and we call for, you know, responsibility to be taken for this act.
I noticed that an Israeli army spokeswoman said she was checking for details, but by the sounds of things, you were in no doubt that this was an Israeli attack.
We have visited the site. Our security staff have visited the site. We've looked at the impact. We've looked at the trajectory of the incoming. We've looked at the fragments from the explosions, and we believe it was Israeli artillery.
It really does go to underline what a representative of UNICEF was saying to us on the program yesterday. There really is nowhere safe in Gaza.
No, this is at least the sixth time that one of our shelters has been struck. Four of those were certain, at least, that they were from tank or artillery fire from Israeli forces. The other two were still investigating. These people in this school had been asked to move out of their areas by Israeli forces in North Gaza. They had sought refuge in this area at the instruction of the Israeli forces.
What has UNRWA, what has the UN said to Israel about this?
Well, we've been in a constant dialogue on this. I mean, this incident is only this morning, but on the other incident, I mean, there was a number of people killed in a school in Beth Hanun last Thursday. Again, calls for a clear investigation, but it just keeps happening. We're not seeing the change that we need, which is that our installations need to be kept neutral by both parties to the conflict. There needs to be a safe place for these people to go.
Can you be any more confident now that this will change? Because as you say, there has been a string of these attacks.
No, we can't. We cannot be more confident because we keep getting assurances that this is, you know, this shouldn't happen or that this was a mistake, but it hasn't stopped.
Robert Turner, thanks indeed for taking our call this morning. That was Robert Turner, who's the director of the UN relief work in Gaza. Time for the sport with Darren.
Good morning, Rachel. It's day three of the Galway Festival. Today's feature is the Tote.com Galway Plate. 22 runners, prize fund of €200,000. Champion trainer Willie Mullins has three horses running. JP McManus could have up to seven runners, including the overnight favourite Alderwood, who will be ridden by AP McCoy. I'm joined on the line by Don McLean of the Sunday Times. Don, let's start with that big race in Galway, the Plate. And is that significant that AP McCoy has decided to go on Alderwood?
It sure is, Darren. Yeah, AP would have had the choice of more or less all the JP horses, bar maybe the ones down the very bottom of the handicap. And absolutely, the fact that it's chosen Alderwood, very, very significant, and there's been money for Alderwood as well earlier in the week. Of course, he's the horse who won the Grand Annual Chase there at Cheltenham. We haven't seen him now since last October, but the fact that the money is for him and the fact that Tom Mullins is trainer, he won the race actually with another JP horse, Bob Lingo, 2 years ago. So it looks like it's all systems go for Alderwood.
Look, it's a big field, high stakes. It looks like a very open race on the whole. Who are you going with in this one, Don?
It is. You could make a case for 10 or 12 of them, Darren. Wise Old Owl actually down the bottom, another JP horse. He's interesting. He's got 10 stone 3 to carry. Mark Walsh rides him, and AP probably couldn't do the weight. He probably wouldn't be able to ride a 10 stone 3, so he maybe didn't have the choice of Wise Old Owl. So he's interesting. He finished second in the race 3 years ago. He's an older horse, and we haven't seen that much of him recently. But again, John Kiley trains him, a very, very astute trainer. And the English horse, well, a couple of English horses coming over, but Ked de Berle, Paul Nicholls' horse, he's interesting. He's only five. And not many 5 year olds run in the race actually, but he was a very progressive hurdler last year. He's only run in two chases, and again, Paul Nicholls said a little while ago that the Galway Plate was his target. He was unlucky at the Entry Festival this year. He hit the front early and then idled a little bit in front. He's got a nice weight as well. He's a wee bit lower over fences than he is over hurdles. So, and he jumped well on his chasing debut. So if he can get into a rhythm as well, he could run a big race.
And who are you going for?
Yeah, I think Ked de Berle. I think at the prices, Darren, like Alderwood's an 8-1 shot. He might go off shorter now. The public might latch on to him, a JP McManus, AP McCoy horse, but I think at around 12-1, Ked de Berle might be a wee bit of value.
Okay, and a final question. Big race at Goodwood today as well. It's the Sussex Stakes, Kingman and Tornado, and massive hype about this particular race. Is Kingman going to run in this?
You'd hope so, Darren, yeah. They were going to pour plenty of water on the course overnight to make sure that it's safe ground. And John Gosden, his trainer, you know, you can't expect soft ground in the middle of the summer. But as long as it's safe for Kingman, he is a horse who does handle soft ground well. But he's shaping up to be a superstar now. He got beaten in the Guineas, but he's won his last two. He came over to Ireland really, really impressive on soft ground here. And then he won the St. James's Palace Stakes at Royal Ascot very impressively. He's taken on the older horse today in Toronado. Aidan O'Brien is Darwin in it as well. But Toronado, he's the big danger to Kingman. He won the race last year. He beat Don Approach in the race last year. And he won the Queen Anne Stakes this year at Royal Ascot when Richard Hughes said that he wasn't fully fit. So he should progress from them. And it should be, as you say, it should be a massive race between the two of them.
Okay, looking forward to all the action today. Thanks for that, Don. Live coverage of the Galway Festival on RTÉ Television today. The racing gets underway at 3 o'clock. The big race goes to post at 5:30. Now, the All-Ireland Football quarterfinals get underway this weekend. Kerry's Stephen O'Brien will miss the game against Galway on Sunday with a quad muscle injury. Michael Ganey replaces him in the half-forward line. Now, just to get you in the mood for the weekend, little treat here this morning in Morning Ireland, let's hear from a Kerry legend. And in a moment, Maurice Fitzgerald. But first, let's listen back to one of the most famous kicks of all time, his equaliser against Dublin in the 2001 quarterfinal at Semple Stadium.
A last chance maybe for Kerry now to be taken by Dara O'Shea. The ball is being taken out by Maurice Fitzgerald. Maurice Fitzgerald is taking a line ball 50 yards out from the Dublin goal on the right hand side of the field. Maurice Fitzgerald kicking it, dropping it in toward the goal, dropping it in. A magnificent point by Maurice Fitzgerald on the 50 yard line on the right hand side of the field. And Maurice the Immortal has sent it over the bar. It was worth coming to see that kick alone. 36 minutes gone, 2 to go. What's likely to happen? I think a draw would be the fairest result of all. That was Maurice's first touch of the ball.
It was like I hadn't played the game other than kick that ball. But listen, any player will tell you that, you know, you have moments in your career that will stand out. And I suppose ultimately, yes, it was a great thrill for me, you know, just to secure the draw for Kerry against Dublin that particular day. What stands out, I suppose, more than anything else was that it was a marvellous occasion in Turles. It was quite different to anything because, you know, it was away from Croke Park. A lot of people speak that whether Dublin were taken out of Croke Park now, maybe it might create more opportunities for us to take victory there. But on that particular day, Dublin came very strong, as did the supporters to Turles. And it was just an absolutely fabulous and marvellous occasion. Personally, I only probably came on the pitch. I had only played maybe 6.5 minutes. And
was it your first touch?
I would say it was my first touch, yeah. And so that made it quite unusual in that sense. But I just had a sense of, you know, if I was going to have only one kick, I had better make it count.
And what did Tom Carr say to you as you were about to kick it?
Very simply, I'd say, Maurice, you'll bang it over. Shouldn't be a problem to you.
I bet he did. The great Maurice Fitzgerald, great year for football, 2001, actually. Meath beat Kerry in the semi-final then.
Destroyed Kerry, yeah.
And then Galway
went down. That was a long time ago now.
You're right there.
That's the first year of the quarterfinals as well, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah. More from Maurice on the 6 o'clock news, and you can hear the full interview at the weekend on Sunday Sport. The Bord Gáis Energy Munster under-21 hurling final between Clare and Cork takes place this evening. It takes place in Ennis, throw-in 7:15. Finally, Celtic away to Legia Warsaw on the first leg of their Champions League qualifier tonight. Anthony Stokes has travelled with the squad after recovering from a hamstring problem. The game gets underway at 7:45.
Darren, thank you.
Why did so many Irish people take up arms in World War One? What were the consequences for their families? And what stories did they have to tell about life in the trenches, about death, destruction and survival? For the first time, the residents of many of Ireland's old country houses who had family involved in the war have recorded their stories as part of an oral history project which is being launched today. Morning Ireland's Justin McCarthy has been listening to their stories and has this report.
We have had rather an exciting time here lately. 3 days ago, our mine and the Germans' mine met, and the Germans blew theirs up with no result.
This is Lord Ross of Burr Castle.
Our miners were going down to do the same, when the Germans used their poisonous gas you have probably heard about lately. I think that this ought to be made as public as possible.
He's reading from a letter written by his grandfather, William Edward Parsons, who fought in the Great War.
Because it seems to us that the government ought not any longer to carry the war on as present, but treat the German as pure savages.
The letter is part of an oral history project in which the residents of Irish country houses were asked to talk about family members who took up arms during World War One.
They returned home, his uniform case, with his sword and other such things that were of no practical value in it, but also containing the uniform he was wearing.
This is Desmond Corbin Lucas of Kilworth in County Cork, speaking about his uncle Percival and the uniform he was wearing when he was killed.
The coat with great holes across the chest and covered in blood, and this thing was sent home. But my mother said to me, it nearly sickened both your father and myself, and what your grandmother must have thought when she opened it and saw this was what was left of her son, I dread to think.
The stories were compiled by historian Maurice O'Keefe.
I think it's very important now that we honour these people and we give recognition to those who participated in the Great War. A lot of them who returned, who were lucky enough to come back, suffered post-traumatic stress and shell shock. And I think that it's important that we don't forget these people, that their memory stays alive, and that we remember them for their bravery and for what they did.
52 families took part in the project, recording their memories so that historians and researchers could access them in the future. Among those who took part were William O'Sullivan, whose uncle, Father Donal O'Sullivan, was a British Army chaplain who died while attending to a wounded soldier.
He was anointing a man when he was killed. That man survived. He was an Englishman. I haven't got his name or anything, but he saved up after the war and came across Killarney to see my mother, or my grandmother, to tell her how Donal died. And he spent a week with her.
Many of the stories are of death in the trenches, tragedy and destruction. But in some cases, there are stories of survival, like this told by Honor Lee from Bandon, whose grandfather, Colonel Henry Savage, and his daughter Rosemary were at the Battle of the Somme.
Most of the regiment had gone over the top, but there was one battery which were to follow slightly later, which was my grandfather, which was Henry Savage. And he was waiting for the call to go over the top with the adjutant and a handful of officers and men, and they never got it. So that was the reason why he survived. He was heartbroken because he felt he'd left his men down. But what had happened was that there was a bomb and it blew up the telegraph system. So he never got the word to go over the top.
Honour Lee, ending that report from Justin McCarthy. That oral history project entitled The Irish Country House and the Great War will be launched this evening at the National Library in Dublin. It will be available in public libraries for free or to purchase on irishlifeandlore.com.
We heard in the bulletin earlier about three men being sent to jail for an attack on a US tourist and his brother in Temple Bar in Dublin 2 years ago. Garth Russell, who still has glass embedded under one of his eyes, echoed the concerns of the trial judge that the three culprits had been at large and free to commit crime despite a litany of previous offences. During sentencing, Judge Patrick McCartan said the juvenile system did not seem capable of dealing with the men at the centre of this case. Gareth Noble is a solicitor with KOD Lyons. He's also a practitioner at the Dublin Children's Court, and he's here in our studio. Gareth, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Is Patrick McCartan right? The juvenile justice system did not seem capable of dealing with the men.
Well, anything that Judge McCartan, as a very experienced judge, says is something that we should all listen to very carefully. And I agree with him to the extent that juvenile courts are not capable by themselves of dealing with this issue. But that it's a wider issue than that. I think I note, for example, that two of the accused before that court were aged 28 and 25.
Yes.
And so by their very nature, they haven't been before the Children's Court for quite a considerable period of time. And I've been practising in the Children's Court now since 2008, and I do see signs of real progress, even in the time since I've been there.
What sort of progress?
Well, for example, you know, we have some very, very good Garda diversion projects, for example. We have some very good mentoring schemes. We have a lot of very, very good probation involvement at a much earlier stage. We also have a very, very good recent system where we have what we call a Garda case management system, which takes guards who are not part of the prosecution. And those guards monitor young people who come before the courts, not just through the court process, but in the community. So I think all of those things together are actually making a real difference on the ground.
Just to read out another of the comments of the judge yesterday. Unfortunately, a day like today comes when they, as in the three culprits, graduate from an overly protective system into an adult court when they are facing serious terms of imprisonment. This is something that needs to be considered by legislators because it's a recurring feature of these courts. Overly protective. What do you think he means there?
Well, I think by its very nature, the 2001 Children's Act looks at a number of measures to try and create a system that saves children from a life of crime rather than condemn them to a life of crime. And I think that that's a very laudable objective. And the position is that when children come before the Children's Court, it is a robust system. It's a system that challenges those children. And it is a system that, for example, if one commits a particular offence and comes before the adult court, one might expect, as an adult, to have finalised that particular case within a very short space of time. In the Children's Court, I have children in the Children's Court that I represent that are there 7 or 8 months in order to satisfy the particular judge that they appear before, that they have made sufficient progress before they can leave the criminal justice system.
One interpretation of his comments might be that the level of custodial sentences or the level of sentencing in the Children's Court is too lenient.
Well, the position is then we had this particular difficulty about 18 months ago where there are in fact no either detention beds or sentence beds in either Oberstown or Trinity House. And that was a difficulty that was expressed by the time by the judge who was sitting there at the time, Judge Anne Ryan. That system improved somewhat. We've also had a system as well whereby a very welcome development has been the closure of St Patrick's Institution for young people. That is promised. 16-year-olds are now no longer in St Patrick's Institution. And those of us who work in the criminal justice system, and in particular in the juvenile justice system, were always very concerned by the idea that children were being detained with adults in an adult institution without the support mechanisms in place. So you have a lot of children who come before the courts who are also in the care system. We know that there are 3,000 vulnerable children out there who still require an allocated and are waiting for an allocated social worker. We need huge investment in our adolescent mental health services. Many children who come before the Children's Court have a lot of mental health difficulties. And it's also clear that, in fact, and when I talk about that the juvenile courts are not capable by themselves of dealing with this issue, we need to be much more creative about identifying young and vulnerable people at risk from a much earlier age. And there are many studies which indicate that children as young as primary school age can be identified as those that could be vulnerable of coming to adverse Garda attention.
Gareth Noble, solicitor, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning.